And it's 8:06 here on KPCW Park City. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Connor Thomas, and happy Pi Day to those who celebrate. It's 21 degrees here in Park City and a cold 22 degrees in Heber. With a better look at the weather from the ABC Forecast Center, here's on the phone with me is meteorologist Thomas Skiboy. Good morning, Thomas.
Morning, Connor. Happy Thursday or happy Friday Eve to you on this Pi Day. So hopefully anybody celebrating with a slice of pizza or maybe just a pie for today. The weather in Park City doesn't look like it's going to be too bad. We will have a slight chance of seeing some showers as we go through today. We'll see a daytime high top out at 39 degrees. So if we do cash in on any wet weather in Park City, it's more likely than not going to be snow. But the main thing that we're watching out for in northern Utah for today and for tomorrow are going to be some stronger winds. So we have an upper level low pressure that's slowly working its way down to our south. And based on the orientation of things, our winds are going to be out of the east. So as we go through today and through tomorrow, there's going to be a potential for some strong downsloping winds and easterly canyon winds. And we do have a wind advisory that's going to be going into effect in the Wasatch Back starting at 9 o'clock this morning and will continue through noon on Friday. So in the Wasatch Back, we're going to see some pretty gusty winds. It's not going to be as bad compared to areas likely along the Wasatch Front, but as we go between today and tomorrow, we could see occasional wind gusts over 50 miles per hour. So if you haven't tied down any loose objects in your yard, might not necessarily be a bad idea to do so. And just keep in mind, as you make your way down Parleys into the Wasatch Front, and if you're going to be traveling northward, especially into Davis and Weber counties, those winds will likely be even stronger than what we're going to see in the Wasatch Back. So we'll be looking at some gusty conditions through today, daytime high in the upper 30s with roughly a 20% chance of seeing on and off snow showers. As we move into tonight, still going to be gusty, still going to be breezy with the overnight low dropping to 21 degrees, so similar compared to what we're waking up to this morning. And then for our Friday, we'll check in with mostly sunny skies. It will be a little bit warmer than what we find out there today with the winds continuing, with the daytime high coming in at 44. The wind should subside as we move into this weekend. I still think it's going to be breezy at times, but our warming trend that we're going to be going on will continue. We'll drop to 24 degrees on Friday night, slight chance of snow showers on Saturday, otherwise mostly sunny to partly cloudy, with that daytime high coming in the mid-40s. And if you think that's nice and mild and seasonal for this time of year, just wait until the back half of the weekend into early next week, because on Sunday we'll likely be in the upper 40s, overnight low in the upper 20s between Saturday night and Sunday night. Then through the first half of next week, each day will likely bring a mix of sun and clouds, with Monday seeing a daytime high of 51, we'll be around 53 on Tuesday, and we'll be in the low 50s again on Wednesday. But by the second half of next week, forecast models are starting to hint that we could be moving back into an active pattern. So as we go through today, cool, breezy with a slight chance of snow, and then we'll be warming from the weekend into early next week. And by early next week, I think it's going to be kind of feeling like spring in Park City, Connor.
Wow. Well, it's the first time I've heard 50s in a long time. Do you think that's the beginning of the end, or active pattern means a cold front on the horizon?
We'll probably see a cold front work its way back through, and typically this time of the year, especially in March, we just kind of go through those ups and downs. It just looks like those ups are starting to get just a little bit higher, and that will probably continue to be the case at least through April.
All right. Thanks so much, Thomas. We just heard that forecast from Thomas Skiboy. On the line is Nikki.
Good morning. So we've got a cold front that kind of moved its way out of northern Utah, but they brought heavy snowfall over the last few days, anywhere between 10 and 22 inches of snow that favored the upper Cottonwoods. The main thing today is that the upper elevation easterly winds are really picking up. We've seen gusts up to 65 miles per hour already. But with all that fresh snow, travel and riding conditions should be great today. I would seize that opportunity earlier in the day, as those easterly winds will start to impact the snow. Yesterday, there was widespread sensitive soft slabs, both of new snow and wind-drifted snow in the backcountry. Most of these were anywhere between 1 to 1.5 in size and ranged 15 to 50 feet wide, running 15 to 100 feet long. Today, we've got two main things to think about. The first is just going to be that wind-drifted snow. So the bump in overnight easterly winds with all that soft snow available for transport will need to form soft slabs of wind-drifted snow anywhere from 1 to 4 feet deep. This will primarily be on the leeward-facing slopes, so northwest through west through southeast. As well, we want to think about the new snow. So we've got a variety of excellent bed surfaces for that new snow to fail on. So the instabilities will begin to settle out today, but outside of the wind zone, we could still find some sensitive soft slabs. So for today, we're going to have an overall moderate danger, upper and middle elevation slopes to start. And then throughout the day, as the easterly winds continue to increase, the avalanche danger will rise to considerable on those upper elevation leeward slopes. So pay attention. As well, remember that easterly winds are unusual for the Wasatch, and with unusual weather patterns comes unusual loading. So throughout the day, pay attention to the rising and changing conditions.
All right. Sounds like a little bit more elevated danger than yesterday. Thanks so much, Nikki. Yeah. I'm Connor Thomas, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up later on the program, first I'll be speaking with Summit County Council member Chris Robinson. He'll recap yesterday's county council meeting. Then Park City Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieters and Basin Rec District Director Dana Jones will both be in studio to talk about an e-bike survey they're putting out for Park City and Basin residents. Lastly, I'll be speaking with Jordan Clayton. He's the data collection supervisor for the Utah Snow Survey at the USDA. He'll be talking about this very good snow that we got in February, recapping this winter and looking at the spring melt ahead of us. That's all coming up. And then stay tuned because it's Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. on this Thursday morning. Linware Peak and Katie Mullally will be speaking with plasma physicist Sierra Salter about the effects of decaying space junk on Earth's ionosphere. Then they're joined by Christopher French, author of the new book, The Science of Weird Stuff, to talk about evidence-based explanations of paranormal beliefs. It's Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Getting into some local news now. First, the Park City Council will consider plans for a housing project on the Mine Bench property off Marsac Avenue today. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has details.
Located in Upper Deer Valley, the city-owned Mine Bench property sits near the Ontario Mine Trailhead by Marsac Avenue and Wheaton Way. Park City officials have considered using the 29-acre swath of land for affordable housing since early 2021. A consultant was brought on to draft a potential site plan, which the Park City Council will review at its meeting Thursday. The consultant is proposing a 300-unit housing project with 660 beds spread across 10 buildings. There would be a mix of studios and four-bedroom apartments, with the majority listed at affordable rates. The plan also includes 220 parking spaces. While the project could provide much-needed workforce housing close to several Deer Valley area hotels, Park City Manager Matt Dias said the location of the property raises questions.
The way I look at this is a very a quality proposal and a very large proposal in a really sensitive area, and this was somewhat of a fishing expedition. So my expectation is council takes a step back and says, is this the right place to do this? I mean, look at the amount of density up here. We understand there's a need, but we also have a lot of other plates spinning, to be fair. We're exploring initiatives in Clark Ranch. We're exploring initiatives down by the senior center.
The council will also discuss accelerating the study for the city-owned five-acre site in Bonanza Park Thursday. The meeting at City Hall starts at 3:45 p.m. with a discussion about potential changes to recreation fees. The agenda and a link to attend virtually can be found online at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And with me on the phone, I have Summit County Councilmember Chris Robinson here to recap yesterday's meeting. Good morning, Chris.
How are you, Connor?
Great. Hope you're well as well. We'll begin with the Board of Equalization. That's the county's role to process property tax appeals. I don't know if you were there to vote on these, but we did get good news yesterday from Stephanie Pohl, at least from the county's perspective, that we're winding down the amount of appeals. I mean, you've been on the council since, what, 2008? I mean, can you remember a year where you've seen this many appeals?
No, I think that last year there were quite a few too, but this has been certainly a high watermark year. And, it is the time to be getting through with them. The appeals that happen now, a lot of them are some of the more difficult cases, or those that go to hearing officers and that haven't been settled with easy stipulation prior. But yeah, I had to step out for that. I had a conflict and I did miss the vote on that, but I think we're on the tail end of that.
They got approved business as usual. I believe that deadline is April 1st, so you expect to see a few more in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I think that's the case.
Gotcha. Speaking of the assessor's office, there's a reshuffle going on there. It sounds like council approved a new position, deputy appraiser, to replace an assessing tech, which is a position that manages greenbelt, business personal property, and primary residential tax exemptions. So a big workload. But Stephanie Pohl said their condo appraiser manages something like 8,700 parcels right now. So the new position would split that job in half. You had that conflict, but council approved this. What were your thoughts on sort of the workload they're seeing at that office right now?
Well, I think the assessor has been signaling for many years since Stephanie's beginning there that she needed more help, and I think this is just the ongoing progression of giving her the people and the tools needed to come up with a tax roll that will stand the scrutiny that it needs to with the tax commission and that it's fair. So I'm in favor of these changes that give her those tools.
Is the hope that it can make it a more efficient process? I mean, from the outside looking in, it's almost like we're having to redo a lot of these appraisals that, you know, we do once in maybe the summer and then people appeal them. It doesn't feel efficient. Do you know, like, what the cost of that is for the assessor's office?
Well, I don't know the cost, but I want to put it in perspective. The county has some 2,000 or 3,000 different parcels. And the assessor's job is to attach a fair value to each of them every year. And so when you say an appraisal, it sounds like somebody's going out and looking at every one of those and writing a report, you know, like if you were having an appraisal done on your home to borrow money from a mortgage broker. That's not what's happening, obviously. You couldn't do that on 40-some-odd thousand parcels. So there's a lot of assumptions made based on square footages and trying to extrapolate from comparable sales and find apples to apples comparisons or adjusting them to make oranges apples through assumptions, which could all be, you know, they're not based on actually going out and looking at each house. So yeah, it's imprecise. It's every 5 years is supposed to be a closer look, you know, that would be akin to maybe probably not a site visit, but, a more thorough review. And so having more help there, you know, leads to a better outcome and it probably makes it more efficient, but it's not a perfect system if we think we're going to appraise every parcel every year.
I'm imagining spreadsheets full of fruits now. When people appeal their properties, do appraisers or people from the assessor's office go out to the properties physically at that point?
Probably not. I mean, I think a lot of the evidence from an appeal would be a property owner coming in and saying, you know, here I've gathered some comparable sales. Or here's a factual error. You've shown that I have an improved basement and I don't. Or, they provide evidence. They might go out and have their property appraised by an MAI appraiser and say, you know, you missed the mark. Here's my evidence. I've got a full-blown appraisal. So I don't think that there's a site visit. They might be in certain circumstances, but I doubt in the majority.
Gotcha. There was one public hearing last night. It was about the grading of a driveway. The builder was looking to build it at 8% the whole way. It was going to be less steep than that, but have to kick up to 12% at the end of the driveway if this special exception wasn't granted. It seems like everyone wants these days. I think there were two last week or the week before in Toll Canyon. Do these requests for special exemptions come in batches from the county building or engineering department, or is this just coincidence?
Well, in this situation, the code says that the first 100 feet of the driveway as it touches onto the road needs to be no more than 5% in steepness, and then it can be steeper from there. And so in this case, the homeowner and the builder got approval for a driveway like that. And then in the course of building it, one of the spouses had a stroke and they decided that was too steep. And so they looked at it without really consulting our code and they built it. So it has this 8% more constant slope that allows maneuvering a wheelchair up and down it and things. And it's not like the driveway's built and it's heated, so it's an expensive driveway. And so the alternative would have been to not grant the special exception, would have been to say, nope, you got to tear it all out, and we want 5% for the first 100 feet and then 12% thereafter. to comply with the strict letter of the code. And so I don't know that there's a big rash of these. I mean, the problem with this one is that they weren't asking permission. They were asking forgiveness, right? It's after the fact. Those that come in and study the code and realize that if they want to make a change and that they need a special exception, then they come in advance, and that's preferable. I don't know what more to say on this other than I think we made the right choice. But as my colleague and friend Roger Armstrong pointed out, that he doesn't like them because we don't want the exception to become the rule, you know, where we're having to grant them all the time.
Well, council did not accept those exceptions that were requested for the driveways a few weeks ago, so it seems like you're not accepting every single one. And Roger is ever the stickler on these. He also mentioned that there's a customary $250,000-some-odd fine for contractors that build these things out of code. Is that, I mean, pardon the pun, but that seems steep. Is that typical?
I heard that comment, and I didn't know where that came from. It seems like a fair bit of money. I thought that, I have no idea what it might have cost to tear that driveway out and put it back in. But I don't have more to say about that other than it seemed like a lot of money.
Fair enough. It sounds like the alternative was lowering the entire house. But during council...
Perspective instead of a retroactive look at it, if they wanted a flatter driveway, they could have designed the whole project, such as lowering the house a few feet, which would have meant there was less elevation to climb, then you could have had a flatter driveway. But again, the house was, you know, already under construction, so the elevation for the house was set, and then they had approval to build the driveway, but then they unilaterally changed it without consulting the county, and that change was in violation.
Gotcha. And during council comments, I think Chair Melina Stevens, she and Roger Armstrong have been negotiating with the University of Utah about the county's mental health service contract with the U. They mentioned that things seem to be progressing well. I think they used the phrase two steps forward, one step back, but that's moving forward. Sounds like we're going to have some options for the council to vote on in the coming weeks. Do you have any update on that contract?
No. I mean, the only background I would give is that my perception is that we really like the arrangement, but that our partner is losing money. So there needs to be some adjustment made, and that's what they're negotiating. How do we come up with a sustainable way of continuing to do what we're doing where our partner isn't bleeding?
And on the subject of the council's coming schedule, I think it was mentioned you have a joint meeting that's tentatively set for March 22nd with the Park City Council. Do you know what the focus of that will be?
Well, one of the big things that we're focused on is, you may have followed that on the 26th of February, the Utah Department of Transportation issued its level 4 screening alternatives analysis for the Kimball Junction SR-224 EIS. That's a mouthful.
It is. That was when they dropped the idea of sinking 224, right?
Well, what they've done is they start out looking at lots of alternatives, and then they kind of winnow the list down, and this last winnowing resulted in alternative B, which was the fly under or sinking down, as you say, of 224, and it's now we have alternatives A and C, and that release triggered a 30-day comment period, and so that period ends on the 27th of March. That's not to say that if we had brilliant ideas, they're going to say, sorry, you're too late. But we're trying to figure out what thoughts we have on the remaining two and other modifications to those that we think might be better. And I'm sure that'll be a big topic.
Gotcha. Something that's not on the schedule right now is these ongoing meetings with Dakota Pacific Real Estate. Again, the developer sort of looking to build housing in Kimball Junction. They own property currently zoned for tech offices. Those meetings have been put on hold for the last couple of weeks. What's the purpose of waiting right now?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is, as we forecast, that we wanted to do some economic analysis of the various proposals that we and they have made, or counter proposals back and forth. And so we're working on that. And then the other thing, and probably the biggest objection that we hear to Dakota Pacific is the concern over the congestion and traffic. And it relates to this business with SR-224 and the UDOT EIS process. And so we have been pivoting our energies to trying to figure that piece out. And now that UDOT has given us their best thinking, now we need to figure out what our best thinking is on it. And so we are taking a little time off from that to try to figure, focus on the transportation solution.
All right, Chris, that's all I've got. Do you have anything else you want to mention?
No, this is our first interview. I've enjoyed that, and thanks for all you do to cover the county, keep everybody informed.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Summit County Council member Chris Robinson, recapping yesterday's council meeting. You're listening to the Local News Hour, and here with me in studio, I've got Basin Rec District Director Dana Jones, Park City Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieters. They've got an update on an e-bike survey available. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Connor.
All right. Well, Park City and Basin Rec have partnered on a survey for residents about e-bikes on trails, as I just mentioned. Maybe we should start with the relevant jurisdictions here. I'm sure everyone's mail says Park City, but where are your different areas of expertise?
How about I'll go first. So the Park City jurisdiction, if you will, most people I say is like the White Barn. So, it's the Ridge, the resorts to the White Barn, and then, Park City Heights. So that's probably the jurisdiction best reference to the layperson. But Dana?
And so that is, basically city limits. And outside city limits, Snyderville Basin is pretty much everything from there out, Summit Park up to the county line there, out back toward Promontory, Silver Creek Village, Silver Creek, that area is all Snyderville Basin and part of Basin Recreation's special district jurisdiction.
All right, and the survey that's going to be available to people could result in potential rule changes for e-bikes on trails. Should we maybe summarize what the rules are right now? Correct me if I'm wrong, but e-bikes are allowed on all paved trails in both of your jurisdictions?
Yes.
Okay, where does that change for unpaved trails? Maybe Heinrich, we can start with you.
Sure, so let's see, Connor, you got me a little off. I was going to go about the interview a little differently, but... just real quick for the listeners, because I think this is an important distinction. If you have taken the survey or when you take the survey, it is somewhat of a complicated or, separated issue, meaning that on pathways we have e-bikes that provide sort of commuter or transportation, alternative transportation options. And when we first dealt with e-bikes back in like 2015, that was sort of the focus. But since that time, not only has the technology changed, but also the availability, meaning costs have gone down, batteries have gotten lighter, et cetera, and stuff. And so you've seen this sort of rise of the e-mountain bike, if you will. So in the survey, we take a bit of time at the beginning to define not only pathways, which would be what you referred to as paved pathways, but then we also talk about natural surface single tracks. And so that's when we're talking about up on the mountain. And so there's two components of the survey, one being the pathways, one being the single track, and they really are the discussions associated with them are somewhat different, and opinions are very different. And actually, some people are very interested in pathways, and not worried about mountains. And then we have a very, very passionate, community that is interested in the trail or e-mountain bike component. So I just wanted to say that because it's a complicated discussion, but it's really, I think someone said two sides of the same coin almost discussion. So I forgot what your question was, Connor.
Wait a minute, I'll jump in on this one. So you know, you were asking if there's a difference between Park City and Snyderville Basin's regulations. As far as the pathways, so the paved transportation trails, those kind of things that you're talking about, there really isn't. We all allow e-bikes on those paved pathways. We don't currently have any kind of speed limits, although we do, you know, caution people to, you know, please, you know, follow the rules of the road, you know, drive safely, you know, don't run over walkers and dogs and things like that. Now on the single track, the mountain, the dirt trails, there is a slight difference between Snyderville Basin and the Park City's trails. And let me just back up one minute and say, we have the luxury, I'm gonna call it a luxury, of having a tremendous amount of trails in our area. Basin Recreation manages over 170 miles of them, and Park City has
about similar. Yep.
So you're looking at almost 400 miles of trails that are out there. Not, you know, so there is a slight difference in how we manage our dirt trails, and in that Basin Recreation does not allow e-bikes on any of the single track dirt trails.
And Park City does allow them for users 65 or older, or those with mobility disabilities.
Gotcha. And that's interesting because, I mean, would a trail like the Bend Mountain Trail count as single track? Because that's one of those ones that goes straight through both jurisdictions, and you might not know which one you're in.
That is very true. And that's, you know, in my mind, that's the impetus for why we're doing this. Yeah. We don't want our users to have to worry about whose jurisdiction they're in. We want our whole operation to be seamless. And so we really, before we could, I mean, Heinrich and I could have gone into a closet and decided what we wanted to do and tried to push it past our individual councils. But we really want to know what the public thinks. And that's kind of why we went with the survey.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we've done, I just went through my notes. You know, we did an initial one in 2015, 2016. In 2019, we actually did the same joint community survey with the basin. It kind of got hijacked with COVID. So we did have changes, but there was, you know, really not a rollout. And then, you know, here we are again. And the impetus of this one, I would say, is Mayor Worrell, you know, got a lot of feedback on the pathway issues and the speeds. And if you've lived in town, you've seen, you know, the kids on the, you know, three abreast, it seems like, or, you know, on the pathways. And so that was probably the impetus, the pathway one, for this discussion. But what a great opportunity, like Dana says, to maybe look at our ordinances again and try to find some commonality between the jurisdictions.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about the nitty-gritty of the survey. I know you've started by mailing it out to a random sample. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
So we sent it to, you know, we have a database that was acquired by our consultants for the jurisdiction and city limits. So we sent out like over 12,000 postcards, if you will. And to date, we've received 850. I bet we're almost at 900 right now, which is an incredible response rate. So our consultant has advised us that they have enough information to provide a statistically significant survey associated with both of our jurisdictions. And so our next step, understanding that a lot of people like to come here not only for winter but for summer, is to provide the opportunity, whether it's the Salt Lake based or people from Texas or Arizona or whatever, now we're going to open an open survey, if you will, and people can take it you know, and provide that input, and we're going to be able to differentiate between the two surveys, between the zip codes, et cetera, and provide sort of a balanced and informed data set to our respective boards and councils.
Gotcha. I think I saw the QR codes are going to be placed on trailheads. Where can people go online if they'd like to take that survey?
So we actually, both Heinrich and my staff are preparing right now social media posts, which will include that QR code and also, or a link to get to that survey. So if you go to either the Park City or Basin social media accounts. You'll be able to find them there. We're also going to, I've already tasked the rangers, we're going to put together a flyer and, you know, put them at all the trailheads. We also would like to go to some of the local bike shops and see if they'll post them for us and any other place, because we'd like, it's kind of a hard time of the year to do this because we're not really catching those users that we would catch during the summer. So we really, and why we're here today, and thanks to Heinrich for setting this up, is to really get the word out so we can really get those folks coming on in and telling us what they think.
Definitely. How long will the survey be open? When do you hope to wrap it up?
Yeah, so, you know, we feel pretty confident that right around 2 weeks or April 1st, we'll close all of the surveys. And then it takes a fair amount of time for the consultants to sort of digest and analyze and put that into a final report. I've targeted with my council right at the beginning of May, and I don't have that right on my that date exactly in front of me. But that will be where we have the consultants come and provide a final report for the community. I'm sure it'll be a packed house. They always are associated with these. And then, Dana, I'm not sure how you're going to address with your board. Do you want to?
Yes. It would probably make most sense because our board meets the second Thursday of the month. So I don't think that they'll be ready for the April board meeting. But so they would probably be in front of the Basin Recreation Administrative Control Board at the second week in May.
Gotcha. And this feels unlikely because, you know, e-bikes stir passions within the community. But what if, you know, the public says we kind of like the rules as is? Is there a world in which you do the survey and you decide, you know, the rules are fine the way they are?
So I think all options are open. Obviously, it's the board and the council's decision. I get, and Dana, you may as well, there's a lot of communities that don't have even just a policy that we get from mountain towns all over the West or back East, and they call, and how did you do it? You know, what it is, I've read your ordinance stuff. And I always try to tell people, look, this is a very passionate topic. Go ask your community. And we have always been very successful asking our community, getting that, and basing all of our ordinances and policies associated with it. And I would have to say this is the same. So whatever that comes up with that survey, I think, you know, the different councils will deliberate on that and understand this is the position of the community. And if we need to make changes, we would consider those. And if not, stay with status quo. Is that... Dana.
Yeah, I mean, why would we survey the public to right. do exactly opposite of what they say? You know, we'll do our best. You know, let's say 95% come out and say all trails should be open to everyone, all e-bikes. You know, we may in that case have a few trails that would just be too dangerous to do. And so there might be, you know, one-offs in that case. But really, we're going to listen to the public, and that's why we're out there asking them.
Yep.
How do you also keep in mind, I'm sure there are a few state laws about e-bikes and, you know, especially regarding age restrictions, I think. How do you make sure that your rules are not bumping up against those or contradicting those?
Well, obviously that's our job, to make sure that we are compliant with state code on certain things. You know, I think specifically for the mountain or single track side, you know, we monitored closely when the state made some definitions associated with e-bikes being bicycles. And we have in the past, it didn't really come up in this session, but the previous one, and I'm gonna say the one before, you know, make sure that we lobbied to have the ability for our jurisdictions or small towns to adopt different ordinances that were maybe more restrictive, et cetera, and stuff. And we've really sort of hung on to that, and I applaud the state for allowing like small communities like Park City to continue that. The flip side, so some of the aspects were helmet laws or age restriction stuff. You know, what we try to do for the rangers in Park City, we do these pathway education programs where we put a little table out on Poison Creek or the rail trail is kind of a hot button place for that. And we just try to stop people and advise them and say, hey, look, these are the rules that are out there. You know, we're not out here to, you know, necessarily give people tickets. We're first and foremost trying to educate people on making the right decisions and, you know, what the state laws are and what the local laws are.
Gotcha. And Heinrich, I did have one write-in question from our Park City reporter, Parker. He was curious because the Park City Council approved a contract to replace the bridges on the rail trail from sort of Bonanza Drive over to Richardson Flat. Could you talk a little bit about why those need to be replaced and what the replacements might look like?
Yeah. So if you've been on the rail trail and gone across those bridges, you will know why they need to be replaced. I know that doesn't really help the listeners, but you know, in short, those are narrow bridges where the decking, we can't even affix it to the actual frame of the bridge. And state parks had the same issue years and years and years. When we assumed the management of it last year, you know, that was one of the, you know, concern areas, because there are loose boards, there are, you know, bolts that are coming up, and we send the teams out and make sure that those are as safe as possible. But it got to a point where we just need to replace those. And that's one of the first steps associated with sort of upgrading, you know, the overall level of service of maintenance and management for that rail trail.
Gotcha. What's the time frame for replacement? Any mitigations planned to make, you know, right, disruptions a minimum?
No. You're a great question. Thanks. I didn't know this one was going to come up. But so council awarded the manufacturing of those bridges. So that is a Utah company that will be building those bridges and stuff. They're doing so. We're targeting delivery of those somewhere late summer and fall. We are actually procuring the contractor to actually then bring in a crane, replace those bridges, et cetera. The good thing about that location is if you're familiar, the Wagon Trail, as we call it, there's a dirt trail that runs parallel to that. So we'll be able to actually close that section of trail, divert people up onto that double track, and then bring them back around. So, you know, it won't be paved, but, you know, I think the flow of the traffic is going to be pretty seamless.
All right. And as y'all mentioned, trail users should keep an eye out on social media channels for the online link to the survey. Do you have anything else you want to mention today?
No, we're just really excited to get these feedback from our users and the residents, and see, it'll be interesting to see if there's any difference in the results between the two groups.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think the timing is good. You know, it'll be May. Who knows how long winter's going to hang around, but it does provide the different boards and councils the ability to sort of implement the plan before July 4th is usually where we see the trail use really go up. So if there are any changes, we provide that signage and ordinance changes, and it'll roll right into the summer.
All right. Thanks again for coming on. We've been speaking with Basin Rec District Director Dana Jones and Park City's Trails and Open Space Manager Heinrich Dieters about an online e-bike survey. And here with me in studio, I've got Jordan Clayton. He's the Data Collection Supervisor for the Utah Snow Survey. Jordan, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, the subject of the interview today is kind of the winter, but the winter all happened in February. It seemed like it was a pretty good month. I mean, could you just give a little overview of what we've been seeing this winter?
Yeah, this winter has definitely benefited from February. We had a little bit of a boost in January as well, but it's really nice to see that turnaround. December was pretty disappointing, and we were getting pretty nervous from a snow survey perspective. We were watching weather stations across the state. And then February came along and really got us back on track to where we want to be. So statewide, we're doing pretty well from a snowpack perspective, about 123% of normal for the state of Utah right now when we consider our water equivalent. That's the amount of water that's stored in our snowpack. And that's a nice place to be compared to where we were a couple months ago.
Definitely. I know the Tribune reported that last month Alta's snow base depth was higher even than it was last year at the same time, February 2023. I mean, I know we were close, but did we break any records last month?
We did at a few, actually six of our snowtell weather stations broke records for the month of February. That particular weather station wasn't one of them, but that just really depends on also how you measure these things. So they're measuring the actual snowfall, and I'm comparing that to our precipitation measurements at our snowtell sites. But when we do, we look at, for example, the closest weather station to right here is Thames Canyon. And that station actually was the second highest for its February precipitation since we installed that that weather station many years ago. So that was encouraging to see for the month of February. Now, the area isn't going to break records for this winter, I don't think. But for the month of February, we definitely boosted our precipitation totals quite a bit.
And you mentioned the snowtell stations. Could you maybe just, we should step back, and could you talk a little bit about the Utah Snow Survey, what the program is, and what your role at the program is?
Absolutely. So the Utah Snow Survey's mission is to measure and monitor the snowpack across the state, and obviously we can expand beyond the state of Utah. In the Intermountain West, we have about a little over 900 of these weather stations. 138 of them are in Utah. And what we do, again, is we monitor the snowpack, and that helps us for a variety of reasons. Obviously, there's a lot of interest in our snowpack from a recreation perspective. Originally, though, the main reason why we put in these weather stations was for water supply forecasting. We want to understand how much water we're going to get when all this snow melts. And so we look at the water equivalent of our snowpack, and we see, therefore, we can make a relationship from that to how much water we think we're going to get when it all melts. We've done that for a long time, and we developed pretty strong statistical relationships.
Gotcha. And, you know, you mentioned some of those numbers. You produce pretty colorful graphs. I think listeners can all go online and access these things. How can people use this? How should the general public use the snow survey?
Yeah, I would encourage anybody to just look up on your favorite search engine, the Utah Snow Survey. You'll get to our website that way. And as you mentioned, we've got these maps that'll show you the percent normal for whatever your favorite area is. You can look at a particular weather station. You can look at a large watershed and see, hey, for this area, this is how well we're doing in this corner of the state of Utah. You can also look at the pop-up graphs that'll show you, hey, this is what the trend has been like. It's a time series for the year. You can compare last year to this year. So when we do that, we can draw on those comparisons we were just talking about. So you asked about my role. I'm the supervisor for the Utah Snow Survey. I've been with the program since 2012. I love working with. We've actually got a pretty small team. Only about 8 of us in the office in Salt Lake City, and it's a lot of work to quality control all the data coming in from those weather stations, go out and actually maintain all those sites every summer. It keeps us quite busy.
Yeah, I mean, what are the things that happen to those sites? It's occurring to me that maybe, you know, maintenance can be quite tricky if they're getting snowed in every winter.
It can. You're putting weather stations out there in the toughest of conditions. They're totally off the grid, and they need to be able to report every hour through every, you know, storm through the course of the year. So what we do when we maintain them in the summer is we go around, we check all the sensors, we check the wiring. We wind up having to replenish the fluid that's in the precipitation gauge. Otherwise, it would freeze after multiple winters. So there's quite a lot to do with each summer's maintenance. But we've got it down to a pretty good system at this point.
And you mentioned some of those numbers. Last month, February, we received maybe 50% more snow than normal, measured in terms of snow water equivalent. So how much water the snowpack contains where it melted. That's, you know, we ended at 117% of normal. So it looks like that means we're on track for what, a guaranteed good snow year, in scare quotes?
Yeah. I like the way you put that. So one of the things that's nice to be able to say as of about a week ago is that because of the great February that we had, we also started off March pretty well. We're guaranteed now to have an above normal snowpack season for the state of Utah. Now, there are some areas of the state that can't say that yet or might not be able to say that at all. But for the state of Utah, we have now reached a point where we are in excess of what we typically get for a normal, statistically normal peak. And so now we're at a point where anything that we get at this point moving forward is a bonus. Clearly, we want all the snow we can get. There's really good reasons why we want all that water when it melts. And of course, from a recreation perspective, we'll take all the snow we can get. But after last year, one of the things we kept talking about is if we could get back-to-back above normal snowpack years, that would really boost our ability to maintain high reservoir levels, to push some of that extra water into those large water bodies like the Great Salt Lake, Lake Powell downstream. And when having another above normal snowpack year now, again, we can say with confidence that we're there, is really beneficial, and we're looking at some really nice surplus flows into those other water bodies.
That's really good to hear. You mentioned, you know, it's different in different places around Utah. What are some of those regional differences? I know we're in an El Nino year, so wetter and colder in the southern U.S. What's that done for Utah?
It's been a little surprising. Actually, both last year and this year have sort of taken the trends of La Nina and El Nino and thrown them out. Because last year was the third La Nina in a row, and you could see what happened last year. We don't normally get those massive precipitation totals during a La Nina year. Last year blew away the trend, and we really don't have strong teleconnections to the El Nino-La Nina cycles. It can be a little bit more of a statistically relevant connection, though, in southwestern Utah. And what we typically expect in an El Nino for southwestern Utah is to have a little bit of a boost in your snowpack and your precipitation right around now and kind of the heart of the winter. And we are seeing this storm and the last storm is starting to look pretty good. This coming weekend looks pretty good for southern Utah. But in general, the opposite has been true. So again, we've bucked the trend. Southwestern Utah has not done quite as well from a percent normal perspective as the rest of the state of Utah. We're still sitting close to normal in all those basins, but not what we would necessarily would have expected from El Nino pattern.
Gotcha. And you mentioned last winter was so crazy. I think we were all quite worried about flooding. This winter, less crazy. Does having less snow make it less likely that we're going to see flooding once stuff starts melting?
Certainly, yeah, that's definitely a connection we can make. We're a little bit early to be worried about flooding at this point, and we're definitely not looking at snow totals that are causing alarm in any sense. Now, I should say our colleagues at the Weather Service are really the ones that really focus most on flooding. That being said, most of our ability to predict flooding has to do with when we get closer to that melt portion of our snowpack season, what the weather forecasts look like, what that month in advance, that 30-day outlook looks like, because one of the things we really benefited from last year is that the melt came off very slowly. We had warm-ups and then we had cool-downs, warm-ups and cool-downs, and it turned into essentially a stair-step pattern of removal of all that snowpack from the mountain, which was exactly what we needed to minimize the flooding impact. And now we really don't know if we're going to even have a threat of flooding this year, but if we do, we would want it to have a kind of similar melt pattern.
Yeah, and it's not your job to forecast the temperature, but I've seen some of the snowtell sites do have forecasts for snow levels. What are those telling you right now as far as the rest of the winter, and how do you generate those models?
Yeah, they're not necessarily forecasts. What we're sort of doing is we're overlaying on top of that time series what we've seen in the past, and it's hard to interpret those without we want it to be able to look forward and say this is what we think is going to happen, and in a sense we can, because it gives us a range of probabilities for what we've seen in the past, but we really don't know. Those aren't necessarily sort of technically a forecast, but what we do is we take from this day forward the full range of observations that we've seen in the past, and we can apply to that full range of observations a statistical distribution. So clearly the outcomes that are in the middle of that statistical distribution are the most likely. And if we project forward based on those, we can say with really no certainty at all, but we can say, you know, pushing forward with what, you know, applying the past to what we're seeing today, we can then say, okay, well, what is the range of possible outcomes? And when we do that, we still have for the state of Utah the possibility we could end up in the top 90th percentile for the state of Utah if we had the best possible snowpack moving forward for each one of those days, and you make a record out of that, that's what you would look at. Not very likely for that to happen, but it's possible. More likely is that we would end up in that kind of 120 to 130% of normal range for the state of Utah.
And, you know, speaking of no certainty at all, I'm asking you to look really far in the future for this one, but last fall was so gorgeous with the amount of water I think we had, you know, all these colors started appearing that were quite vibrant. How much water do we have right now? Are we in luck for leaf peeping this coming fall?
I would love it if that were true. I have no idea about the leaf peeping, but I will talk about the moisture that you referenced. Although I am curious to talk to someone who knows more about leaves than mm-hmm. I do, because that's definitely of interest. One of the things that we definitely benefited from, both from the incredible snowpack last year and also because we did get some fall moisture, is that our soil moisture is in excellent shape for the state of Utah, particularly in northern Utah. And the other thing that's really in excellent shape because of all those things that I mentioned is the reservoirs. So just real quickly about both. The reservoirs, which I'll hit first, are at 82% of capacity right now statewide, not counting Lake Powell. So 82% of capacity is roughly 30% higher than we were last year at this time. That's an incredible boost to our water supply, and it really reinforces what I said before about we're not going to have to fill up the reservoirs as much as we did last year, and that means a lot of extra water can then make it downstream to those larger water bodies like the Great Salt Lake. Soil moisture, similarly, in really good shape, above normal for the state of Utah, definitely in this area, that's true. And what that does is when the snow starts to melt, is we get a much better, a much more efficient delivery of that snow water into our downstream reservoirs. When the opposite is true, when we have really dry, kind of parched soils, they soak up a lot of that snow moisture, and it doesn't make it downstream.
And, you know, you mentioned all this moisture. How does that correlate to fire risk as we head into the summer?
Yeah, both the excellent soil moisture and the above normal snowpack reduce the fire risk. Again, a lot of it's going to depend on how the snow melt goes. If we melt really fast and we dry up really quickly, we're still going to have, unfortunately, a pretty high fire risk because of that. It just remains to be seen what the temperatures do.
All right. I think that's all I have. Jordan, do you have anything else you want to mention?
No, I just really appreciate being on the show.
All right, thanks for coming on. We've been speaking with Jordan Clayton. He's the supervisor of the Utah Snow Survey. They do data collection, tell us all about the snowpack statewide and locally. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Connor Thomas, sitting in for Leslie Thatcher. Thanks so much for listening.